Welcome to Soundbites, true stories told by local Mainers and nationally recognized storytellers. The themes are always changing and the hosts are from all over the nation, but when you hear the name Soundbites, you're in for a unique storytelling experience. Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. This story was told at Frontier in Brunswick, where the event's dedicated theme was seen and unseen. Here's today's host, one of Soundbites' very own producers who lives here in Portland, Donna Galuzzo.
That was really, really sweet. Thank you. So my mother was one of five children. She was the only girl, two older brothers and two younger brothers, and the second to youngest brother was my Uncle John, and definitely one of my favorite uncles. We all have those favorite aunts and uncles, right? So we grew up in Ossining, New York. My mom and her family actually grew up in the neighboring town, Briarcliff Manor, and Ossining actually has a couple claims to fame. It's the home of Sing Sing Prison, which is a very famous prison. And you see those like old prison movies and they would be like, he's going up the river, Marty. You know, so up the river meant Sing Sing because it's on the Hudson River, and it's this prison, of course, it's banked by the river on one side and this great wall on the other side, which my great uncle was the contractor who built the wall on the other side of Sing Sing. So a lot of history in town for us. A lot of prison connection. You guys are like, great, what does that mean? Good. One of the other claims to fame for Ossining more recently is if you're a fan of the show Mad Men, that's where Don Draper's house was, Ossining, New York. Oh, and a scene from Fatal Attraction was shot there. So that's it, I'll stop now. So that's where we grew up, and my Uncle John, who I was talking about before, actually worked at Sing Sing Prison. And he was that favorite uncle, you know? He was the guy who took us out for ice cream and the guy who took my brother and I out for ice skating and hot chocolate. And he drove this great yellow car. I'm pretty sure it was a convertible. I think it was a Buick. And we would just like wait on the porch of my grandparents' house, excited for him to roll in and go somewhere with him. He just made everything fun. And he was always getting us stuff. One of the last things he ever gave my brother and I was a 45, like, you know, record players, if you're a record player person, those little 45 singles. He gave us one by a British band called Vanity Fair. They had kind of, I think this was a one-hit wonder, Hitchin' a Ride. Do you remember that song? Yeah, there's like all of us who were, when's my birthday? October 5th. How old am I? 55. Those of us in that age group and older, it's a great song. Remember that, Hitchin' a Ride. So in the spring of, the late spring of 1970, I remember it really well because it was an unusually cold spring, even for New York. And it was very rainy. It was a long, long, like chilly, rainy stretch of a couple weeks. And one of the things that sticks out in my mind about that spring is that one night my uncle didn't come home. He lived with my grandparents, he worked at the prison. My grandfather was also a prison guard at Sing Sing, and lived with them and just didn't come home. And in the weeks that he was missing, of course, there was a police investigation. And so during this investigation, what I remember as a kid is a lot of flashes to groups of adults kind of huddled around whispering. You know, we'd be at my grandparents' house and you could tell all the adults were talking about it and you'd walk by and the whispers would get even lower and you know, I was at the level where I was seeing like lots of thighs because I was young, I was like 6 or 7. But I remember people seemed stressed and on edge. And I remember my mother telling me many years later that she had a dream early on after my uncle was known to be missing. And in the dream, she had this premonition that he had died. And so she was really on edge. And I was also really impressed thinking back about it as an adult now, that my parents dealt with this really scary thing. And they really tried hard to make life so normal for my brother and I. And when I think about it now, from this age that I am, I think, God, I don't even know how they kept it together for the weeks that they did. And, you know, everybody feared the worst, but I think also they didn't want to say anything until they knew what the result of all this was going to be. There was a point during the investigation when they found my uncle's car, the yellow car, and my mother and her youngest brother were asked by the police to help make a positive identification. And again, another memory that my mom shared with me many years later, when they saw the car, they looked through it throughout, and they opened up the trunk, and there was a very substantial blood stain in the trunk, and it was large enough that I think they had all assumed that a body had been laying there. And she said she remembers leaving that scene and just, you know, having that feeling that went from a knot in her stomach to just kind of getting violently ill, just because, again, you know, everybody feared the worst. So after a two-week investigation, my uncle's body was found, and unfortunately, he had been killed, obviously, and was found close to home. And it was a really rough spring, but he'd been out in the elements, and so there was a fair amount of decomposition for the body. And my father, this was his brother-in-law, my father went to identify my uncle's body. My dad was an only child. The thing about my dad identifying the body is that, and we do joke about this in our family, it's pretty significant because my dad is the guy who fainted when my parents had the blood test for their marriage license. Truly, truly the guy who fainted. He's the most squeamish person in the world. But it always struck me that he did this and he did that for my mom and her family. And I've asked him about it a couple times. He's never really talked about it other than to say that it was really hard. And I always feel like from the look on his face that he really remembers it. But that's what you do sometimes, right, for people that you love. So body was found, and at some point, before all this came to be, while they were in the two-week investigation, it had become apparent, as they were trying to figure out what happened to my uncle, that he led kind of a second life. And I mentioned that he lived at home, and they went through his closet and his drawers, and, you know, they talked to all his friends, and evidently what they discovered, all sorts of things like matchbook covers with the names of really well-known gay clubs in New York City, a lot of leatherware in his closet, leather accessories. I'm not talking like about watch bands, but you know. So everybody realized this was the guy who had the same girlfriend for 5 years. He was really slow to progress the relationship. And he never really had more than that one girlfriend. So once they started to piece it all together, this is again 1970, it was so shocking to everyone to think that he had clearly led this other life that nobody knew about. Three brothers and a sister, lived at home with his parents, had a steady girlfriend, and yet he had this complete alter ego that nobody had ever known about. And once we found out that, it was a huge, big deal, obviously, for the family, but, you know, once we found out that Uncle John was gay, my parents were very open about it, and, you know, I was 6 going on 7 when he disappeared, and it didn't, in a funny kind of way, it didn't surprise me. It's so funny how when you're little, I can't even, because I felt like my nephews felt this way about me. You just know. I don't know what it is, but we knew. My brother and I just knew. We didn't even have a word for it. We just knew that Uncle John was different. Not in a bad way or not in a better way, but we just knew. So fast forward from that moment, about 25 years, And I am now like in my early 30s, and I had more recently come out. I know, hard to believe to look at me, but I was a late bloomer. Really, I'm not joking. All this was really long at one point. Anyway, so I had just come out, and my mom and I, it had been rough waters, and my mom and I were working hard on getting back to where we had always been with each other and kind of patching that relationship up. And I was in grad school at the time, and I had a really cool class with a great assignment, and the assignment was to write a 4-part autobiography. And I was on the phone with my mother. I've lived away from home a long time, and I had the best mom in the world. I was really blessed, and we had a very deep and fierce love for each other, and we spoke on the phone all the time. And I was doing something that I had done my whole life, even as a grad student in a master's program. I was going over my homework with her. I read the autobiography to her over the phone. She asked me to, in fairness to me. She was so cute, like that. What are you working on? Why don't you read it to me? Oh, interesting. So this was we went through chapter 1, which was very intense for us. This was chapter 2, which is about childhood. And of course, I wrote about my uncle because, you know, for me, at that point in time, in my coming out journey, obviously his death and the secret of him being gay and all that was obviously very prominent on my mind. So we were talking about that, and I was reading her installment number 2 of my autobiography, as if she didn't know all about my life already. And every single bit of it. But she said something that really surprised me, and she said it as if I had always known it. And it was kind of a, you know, well, yeah, that's why I was so upset when you came out. And I was like, huh? Like, I wasn't really connecting the dots. And so I was asking her, like, I don't understand what you're trying to say. What are you trying to say? And she's like, your uncle's death. That's why I was so upset when you came out. I was like, I'm still not getting it here. And she told me what I had never known, which was, the story they had told us about his dying was something they sort of conjured up. So what they had always said to us was, oh, well, your uncle stopped to give a ride to 2 guys who were hitchhiking that he knew, and they tried to steal his wallet, and a fight ensued, and it got out of hand, and he died. And that was the story we were always told. And I know that was the story, as it really sticks in my mind, because remember back to Vanity Fair? And they said the RPM that we got, the one-hit wonder, Hitchin' a Ride, right, was the last thing he ever gave us, was that song. And, you know, my brother and I were like, oh, my God. You know how kids do that thing where you're like, whoa. Uncle Johnny gave us the song Hitchin' a Ride, and then 2 guys hitching a ride killed him. I mean, we were just like, oh my God. I mean, to us, it was like the freakiest thing in the world. So I always remembered it. And, you know, that was the story that my parents had always told us. I came to learn later that evidently there were 2 men involved in his killing. My mom said that one of the men was intimately involved with him. He was also married. I think there was some conjecture about whether the guys were cousins or brothers or close friends. And something happened, and this is the part that nobody knows, but evidently there was some kind of fight, and it was either because, again, all conjecture, was one of these men a jilted lover? Was one of these men afraid that he was going to be outed by another? You know, was it a scene created somehow about some sort of love triangle thing that was going on? And so I don't at all think that the act of the killing was premeditated, but I think it was really more of a series of mishaps connected to the fact that there had been this relationship and they were trying to figure out how not to expose people or what not to happen next. But that was pretty jaw-dropping for me to have gotten, you know, through another 20-plus years of my life And then, you know, having learned that actual story. And, you know, and it was interesting, too, how my mom had sort of thought that we knew that all along. And then had sort of come to the place of, you know, saying, "My, how could you not know?" And that made a lot more things make sense in terms of my own coming out. And of course, it was 1970 when that happened, and I don't have much evidence of any kind about what the real story was. I was always really curious about it. I still am. But in those days, everybody tried to shove everything under the rug for the sake of the family. And so the police didn't say much, and they kept it quiet, and they all kept it on the down low, and the paper would never reveal facts like that. And the family, I think, was just as happy to sort of live a lie. And they caught the guys. There was a plea bargain thing, and they were sentenced to 5 years and got out in 2. Yeah, so, well, it was, you know, again, it was a very different time. And so my whole life, interestingly enough, though, what has been most prominent about that whole thing has been his coming out. I mean, he was outed posthumously, which is very sad, but it's been the thing that's always been first and foremost in my mind, and it's been the thing that's been first. It's been the lead story in my family always. And so now, at this point in my life, you know, with my own personal story and the history that I live, I've really thought a lot about it in these last few years. And when I tell the story now, the part that stands out to me, of course, is he was killed because of his sexual orientation. He was essentially the victim of a hate crime. And it's so important to me, first of all, to retell the story. And secondly, it's been incredible to sit back and think how things change and how you see things differently with time, with the passing of time in your own life, with your experience. And I think about that, and I think Uncle John was my favorite uncle. And so first I knew him as that favorite uncle, and then I knew him as someone who was closeted and had come out and been outed and had led this secret life. And then I knew of him as someone who was a victim of a horrible hate crime. And then I thought about my mom, and I was like, oh, and there's my mom, who at first, at some point, I knew her as somebody who was struggling with me coming out, and I couldn't figure that out because she loved her brother who was gay, and it just didn't make sense to me. And then I got to see her and know her as a woman who was just fearful for her child. And then I got to see her as the mother that I remember her as, you know, the person that we just had fierce love for each other. And then I thought about these guys, and for me, they'd always been just sick individuals who did a hateful and hatred thing, and that's how I saw them for most of my life. And then at some point, not too many years ago, I started to see them also as victims of a society that's still very homophobic. And I started to realize that they were afraid, maybe so afraid that they were willing in a moment of absolute terror to do the unthinkable and take somebody's life to avoid being outed. And so these two people that for me at one point were the epitome of hatred, really, are now two people that I see that I can have compassion for. Thank you.
Donna Galuzzo began her career as a third grade teacher in the South Bronx of New York City. Since then, she's lived and worked in Washington, D.C., Toronto, Canada, and of course, Maine. She's worked in education, finance, advocacy, media arts, and HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment. In December of 2012, she and her wife were one of the first couples to legally marry in the state of Maine after Donna wooed her spouse with a shared love of iceberg lettuce. Donna currently lives in Portland's Arts District with her wife and their adorable golden doodle, Teddy. We're going to learn more about our host here on Soundbites.
Donna, what is your connection to Maine?
I first came to Maine to go to college. I actually followed my brother here, who also went to college in Maine, and we had two pretty awesome years in school together.
This is the one that interests me so much. What got you into storytelling?
That is all about this incredible chunk of time I spent at the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. It was my entrance into storytelling as a listener. And then after many, many years of listening, I started running into people who were doing storytelling workshops and storytelling events, and then was just fortunate enough to have my name picked out of a hat, get up on stage, and that was it. That was all I needed.
You had the bite.
I totally had the bite.
What is your process for preparing to tell?
It's a little different each time, but generally speaking, I typically think my story through, then I write my story out, then I try to speak it out loud. I might record it on my phone, play it back for me a few times. If I have enough time, I almost always say it out loud to my wife. She's a great editor. Yeah.
Cool. Tell us about one part of your story, some behind-the-scenes detail that you are not including in your tell tonight.
One detail that I couldn't really find a place for, but I talk about my uncle who has passed, and growing up, I only had one photograph of him. In fact, in the whole family, we could only find one adult photograph of him, and he worked at Sing Sing Prison in New York, and it was the photograph for his, must have been his work badge, so it looked kind of like a mugshot. And it's like a split-screen photograph, and it's very serious, and one's a full-face, head-on picture, and the other one's a profile. And that's the only photograph I have of him.
Soundbites is made possible by the generous contributions of Allagash Brewing, Frontier, The Press Hotel, and by the listeners of Maine Public Radio. Special thanks also to Toad & Co. More information about Soundbites, including how to attend a live storytelling event, is online at soundbitesme.org. And of course, you can always hear more stories at mainepublic.org.